lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears.
The broader agenda that I'm interested in is reclaiming our food, bringing production, you know, back to earth, recreating alternatives to mass-produced foods. Since the Second World War, the development, you know, first in the U.S. and then most of the rest of the world following suit, has been centralizing production, mass production of food. As far as I can tell, the mass production of food has been a failure.
Good pony, and you give me your bed.
You're listening to episode 707 of Unwelcome Guests, Returning to Earth. I'm Robin Upton. With all these shows we've been having on deep politics, I felt the need for a change of pace, so this is our first episode on permaculture since 667, and we've just heard Sandor Katz declaring the centralization and processing of food to have been a failure. Now, just as John Taylor Gatto exposed mass compulsion schooling as a fraud, it was never designed to facilitate the education of children. It was designed exactly to prevent their proper education. I think the case could be made. I'm not in a position to make it myself, but it just strikes me in the same way it might actually be a success for policymakers whose vision of a centralized food system did not necessarily involve healthy people and a healthy planet. Now, given what we know about the commercial imperative, the normalization of psychopathic greed, and the endemic corruption at the highest levels of our political and economic structures, I think it would be naive to discount the possibility that a destruction of human health, far from being a failure, isn't actually a success of an unstated policy. I've commented on several shows previously about health regulations, about food safety standards being rolled back. This, I understand, as a direction of the ecological crisis, that we are not experiencing a global food crisis as an actual shortfall in food, because hungry people tend to stop at not very much in order to fill their bellies. And such an obvious failure to provide even basic subsistence for people is hardly going to help political stability. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to discover that a conscious decision hadn't already been made in certain places to roll back food safety standards in order to allow the poorest and the hungriest people to be sickened rather than to be starved outright. But whether it was a conscious conspiracy or just a sad and predictable result of a whole bunch of decisions made, possibly 20-something floors up in a box of concrete by professional experts trained in customer loyalty, quarterly profits, import-export ratios, and a whole bunch of other modern techniques, in one sense, doesn't actually matter. This show, we're going to be trying to return to Earth. I've spoken a great deal over the years on the money system and how I would like to live in a world without money. The question that always comes up is, well, what are we going to eat? And it's a very good question and a very important one. The idea of living without money certainly has its appeal, but it does also seem very daunting for almost everybody who lives in a city. We're going to be looking at a return to Earth, a return to a connection with the soil, with the land around us, with the local culture. We begin the show with one page reading from the great Ivan Illich from a quarter century ago. He and his friends issued the following Declaration on Soil. The ecological discourse about planet Earth, global hunger, threats to life, urges us to look down at the soil, humbly, as philosophers. We stand on soil, not on earth. From soil we come, And to soil we bequeath our excrements and remains. And soil, its cultivation and our bondage to it, is remarkably absent from those things clarified by philosophy in our Western tradition. As philosophers, we search below our feet because our generation has lost its grounding in both soil and virtue. By virtue, we mean that shape, order, and direction of action informed by tradition, bounded by place, and qualified by choices made within the habitual reach of the actor. We mean practice mutually recognized as being good within a shared local culture that enhances the memories of a place. We note that such virtue is traditionally found in labor, craft, dwelling, and suffering, supported not by an abstract earth, environment, or energy system, but by the particular soil these very actions have enriched with their traces. Yet, in spite of this ultimate bond between soil and being, soil and the good, philosophy has not brought forth the concepts that would allow us to relate virtue to common soil, something vastly different from managing behaviour on a shared planet. We were torn from the bonds to soil, the connections that limited action, making practical virtue possible, when modernization insulated us from plain dirt, from toil, flesh, soil, and grave. The economy into which we have been absorbed, some willy-nilly, some at great cost, transforms people into interchangeable morsels of population, ruled by the laws of scarcity. Commons and homes are barely imaginable to persons hooked on public utilities and garaged in furnished cubicles. Bread is a mere foodstuff, if not calories or roughage. To speak of friendship, religion, and joint suffering as a style of conviviality, after the soil has been poisoned and cemented over, appears like academic dreaming to people randomly scattered in vehicles, offices, prisons, and hotels. As philosophers, we emphasize the duty to speak about soil. For Plato, Aristotle, and Galen, it could be taken for granted. Not so today. Soil on which culture can grow and corn be cultivated is lost from view when it is defined as a complex subsystem, sector, resource, problem, or farm, as agricultural science tends to do. As philosophers, we offer resistance to those ecological experts who preach respect for science but foster neglect for historical tradition, local flair, and the earthy virtue, self-limitation. Sadly, but without nostalgia, we acknowledge the pastness of the past. With diffidence, then, we attempt to share what we see, some results of the earth's having lost its soil, and we are irked by the neglect for soil in the discourse carried on among boardroom ecologists. But we are also critical of many among well-meaning romantics, Luddites, and mystics who exalt soil, making it the matrix, not of virtue, but of life. Therefore, we call for a philosophy of soil, a clear, disciplined analysis of that experience and memory of soil, without which neither virtue nor some new kind of subsistence can be. Now, the good news on soil depletion, serious though the problem is that it's not in the same timescale as oil depletion. doesn't involve waiting around unspecified periods of time for geological processes to replace what humans have plundered from out of the ground. I've been composting all my kitchen waste for years now, and it's a good nitrogen source, so I just mix that with some carbon, some dried leaves or some paper or wood or something, and it composts very nicely and goes onto the plants. So this presents a ready solution to the problem of soil depletion. Now, admittedly, things are more complicated if land has been damaged by chemicals or heavy metals or other pollutants. But, as we shall hear from Paul Stamets in just a minute, we are not alone in our efforts to try to clean up planet Earth. An enormous number of other life forms out there do seem both capable and willing to do their best to clean up the mess that mankind has made of this planet. And what's more, they have hundreds of millions of years of experience at building soil. And this interview is by Meredith Medland from 2007.
In the late 70s, you got a license from the DEA and you studied psilocybin mushrooms.
That's correct. I was covered by a DEA license. My professor, Dr. Michael Bugue, had it, and I was listed on the license as one of the researchers. I was fascinated by the psilocybin mushrooms and did a lot of work with the electron microscope and was a significant contributor to Dr. Gaston Guzman's monograph on the genus Psilocybe, which is a world monograph, and in that genus the majority of psilocybin active species. I have named four species in that genus to date that still survive in the scientific literature. Sometimes when you name species, they're thrown out later by other mycologists. I'm happy to say that after 25 years, they still stand as being valid species. And this led me into cultivation. And then as my horizons broadened, I started to become very interested in growing other types of mushrooms, non-psychoactive ones. My mother was happy about that. So I started getting into gourmet and medicinal mushrooms, and that's really opened up a whole new arena. And the more that I studied the subjects, the more I realized I didn't know and how much more there is to know. And there's a wealth of knowledge inherent within fungi that we're just beginning to learn about.
Yes, indeed. It's been really fun researching you for this interview. For those of you who would like a little more background on Paul as we continue, he's been a mycologist and a mushroom enthusiast since the late 70s. He's pioneered tons of things as it relates to edible mushrooms, credited, like you said, with the discovery of four mushroom species. You've got six books now. You speak on conferences all over the world. You have a very, very deep vision of what an interconnected world environment looks like. And also the underlying thing that I've understood is that you really believe fungi can solve our world's problems. In fact, I've read that you've been saying mushrooms will save the world, and you also coined the term mycoremediation to describe the use of fungus to clean up environmental problems and absorb toxins.
Well, I've coined the word mycorestoration, which includes mycoremediation, mycofiltration, mycoforestry, mycopesticides, and the use of fungi to help stabilize ecosystems. What I think the kind of take-home message that listeners would benefit from is to realize that when the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago and coalesced out of stardust, the first organisms first appeared in the ocean. The very first organisms on land were fungi. They marched on the land 1.3 billion years ago, and plants followed 600 million years later. Now, fungi munch rocks. They produce oxalic acids and other enzymes and acids that actually will take minerals out of rocks and make them crumble. And there is at least two cataclysmic events to steer evolution on this planet. 250 million years ago, there was a huge asteroid impact, and when that occurred, enormous amounts of debris were jettisoned into the atmosphere. The Earth became shrouded in dust, the skies darkened, and sunlight was cut off from the face of the Earth. For years, decades, we really don't know how long. But because there was no sunlight, plants died, large animals died, not more than 90% of the species actually went extinct, and fungi inherited the Earth. The organisms that paired with fungi survived, obviously, because most of these fungi do not require light. And so life then again began to proliferate, and lots of species then evolved, and then we marched forward again until this is 65 million years ago, and bam, we get hit again. There's a recurring theme here, folks. And so, again, with the second asteroid impact, the Earth was shrouded in dust, the sunlight was cut off, and fungi re-inherited the Earth. From those two asteroid impacts, that steered the cooperation or symbiosis of animals and plants with fungi. And so we exist today in collaboration with fungi. They are the construct of the food web. Fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers in nature, and they break down plant, animal, and minerals into soil. And so these are the great soil magicians of nature. And most everybody knows that the topsoil on the Earth is incredibly thin. And yes, it supports, you know, hundreds of billions of different species that live in the very top 6 inches. This thin skin that has given us life is greatly threatened. And as we lose biodiversity, especially with fungi, we begin to unravel the very food networks that have given rise to us. And even though we could be called an evolutionary success, I like to think that every organism on this planet has a vote. And if there's a United Organization of Organisms, otherwise called if every organism voted, we'll be voted on the planet or off the planet. I think that vote's happening right now. And unless we pay attention to preserving biodiversity, the very organisms that give us life will be destroyed. What is most unfortunate is that we are recognizing the role and the importance of these organisms as they are becoming extinct. And like rivets on an airplane, how many species will we lose before we have catastrophic failure? And I think that we are top-heavy right now from the evolutionary sense, and we're losing the very ground support network that has given us life. And if we're not careful, the rule of nature is when a species exceeds the carrying capacity of its ecosystem, nature revolts. And I think we will see a viral storm in the very, very near future. And these viral storms are a direct result of loss of biodiversity and the efforts of nature to knock down the virulent organism, which unfortunately, it means us.
There's a lot of people who I've spoken with who are taking what you're saying very, very seriously, big experts in the environmental movement. I've also, a lot of the conferences, LOHAS and other places I've been, even in the last 2 months, people, your name is out there and people are taking you very seriously. In our last interview on Living Green, Sarah Haynes, who's with the Spitfire Agency, she's working with Daryl Hannah to green the Virgin Conference or Virgin Music Festival that's coming up. Completely passionate. People are hearing about you through the grapevine. And one of the things I'd like our listeners to get out of this show today is a soundbite that you give them, or a few soundbites, about who you are and what your message is, so they can literally repeat that.
Well, it's tough for me to encapsulate it in one phrase, but I am a mycelial messenger. If anyone gets anything out of this, it's the role and importance of mycelium in nature. And unfortunately, the problem that we face in our society is, if you mention mushrooms, people think about portobellos or magic mushrooms. And there's a form of biological racism that has prevented science from using these fungi and the mushroom-forming fungi to our advantage. When people understand that the largest organism in the world is the mycelial mat, over 2,200 acres in size, and yet it's one cell wall thick, we have 5 or 6 skin cell layers that protect us from infection. How do these mats achieve the largest masses of any organism in the world and be one cell wall thick, surrounded by billions of hungry microbes per gram that want to eat this highly nutritious network of cells? It's because the fungi are in constant biomolecular communication with this ecosystem. They're articulate. They're inherently intelligent. We are born from fungi. 600 million years ago, we separated from fungi. Fungi are our ancestors. We respire carbon dioxide, so do fungi. We inhale oxygen, so do fungi. Our best antibiotics against bacteria come from fungi, but we don't have very good antifungal antibiotics because they harm us because of our close relationship. In the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbiology, a new superkingdom was erected 2 years ago called Opisthokonta, recognizing that fungi and animals belong to one superkingdom. So if we understand that the evolution of life on this planet, and we have fungal origins, then understanding how to use these fungi as our hereditary partners can greatly have a positive impact in being able to support life systems on this planet. Fungi move quickly, and I have lots and lots of examples, especially recently, of how important fungal biodiversity is. One example, I've been working with the BioShield program of the U.S. Defense Department, submitted over 300 samples. They've analyzed over 2 million so far, and one of my samples of mushrooms that comes exclusive of a species called Agaricon, Phormetopsis officinalis, comes exclusively from the old-growth forests of Washington, Oregon, in British Columbia, now thought to be extinct in Europe. This mushroom, exclusive of the old-growth forest, has within it very strong anti-pox properties, which include smallpox. The BioShield program has affirmed this. There is a vetted DOD press release. If you Google Stamets and then smallpox, people can read it. And our research has further continued, and I'm bound by confidentiality agreements, but we may be navigating to a whole new class of antivirals. Now, if we lost our old-growth forests, if we lost the species that grows exclusively in that forest, as they have in Europe, and there was a smallpox epidemic, and after 1980, no one has been immunized against smallpox, and so we are extremely susceptible to a smallpox epidemic. If we had lost the biodiversity within the forest that has the species that potentially could fight smallpox, millions of lives would be at stake. And so we can't say now whether it will be clinically applicable, but all indications thus far are extremely positive. The BioShield program is funded with $4 or $5 billion, and they have some of the best testing protocols of any laboratory in the world, and we have passed all of their major benchmarks. And so there's also, if you don't mind me mentioning, there's a NPR.org interview with myself and a representative from the BioShield program and the former assistant director of the FDA, who founded the Bioterrorism Institute, all saying that my work with these fungi is exciting. It was unexpected, but this is what the BioShield program was set up to do, is to find unusual, to find new medicines that were coming from unexpected sources. And so I make the argument we should save the old-growth forest as a matter of national defense. Most listeners may not know the history of the use of penicillin, and there was actually a housewife in 1942 sent in a moldy cantaloupe to a military hospital laboratory in response to the U.S. government's plea to Americans to send your moldy fruit to this one location. From her moldy cantaloupe came a strain of Penicillium chrysogenum that produced 200 times more penicillin than the government had in any of their laboratories. Her strain led to saving millions of lives, and the Japanese and the Germans did not have penicillin, but the Americans and the British did. So that's an example of biodiversity. But this mushroom growing in the old-growth forest doesn't enjoy the widespread habitat distribution that a penicillium mold does. It's restricted. We need to invest in our ecosystems. Biodiversity is absolutely critical to human survival, and nature, through hundreds of millions of years of experiments, has many great successes and how to navigate through many of the issues that we face today by looking back and looking towards nature to see the experiments that have been successful. We can gain a lot of tools that have been tested in the theater of evolution that are extremely helpful to us. And so rather than going to molecular modeling and great computers and being able to play God, which, you know, I know it incentivizes researchers and scientists because they can pull all these patents, I think it's much better that we go full circle and we look at the very habitats that's given us life and understand those complex interrelationships.
Paul, let's go right into your belief system. So I imagine this is a big belief system and we have a short interview here, but what's different about your perspective on the planet that isn't being spoken about in regular circles in everyday conversation?
Well, you asked me to push the envelope here, and I believe that nature is intelligent. I believe that we are born of nature, and if we are intelligent, then by definition, nature must be, because nature gave rise to us. The structure of the mycelium mimics that of the computer internet. I first proposed this in the mid-1990s, that mycelium is Earth's natural internet. As you walk upon these membranes of cells, these are neurological landscapes that infuse all soils. They are sentient. They are aware that you are there. As you leave your footsteps, the mycelium reaches up and responds, grabbing newly available broken twigs or sticks, etc. And I think nature all around us is conscious of our presence, whether we are conscious of nature's presence, of course, is a totally different matter. When I proposed that mycelium is Earth's natural internet, I got a lot of flack for this, but I'm really happy that Dr. Nick Reed from Edinburgh and another group of scientists from Oxford came out with two papers this year looking at the mathematics of internet theory and then the structure of the nodes of crossing as mycelium grows. And lo and behold, using the same mathematical formulas, they found that through evolution, mycelium has optimized its nodes of crossing and the design of its networks to the same optimum that the computer internet theory also is seeking. And so those two graphs actually fall right on top of each other, and there's a series of astonishingly powerful papers that really supports my view. These are neurological landscapes, and we chose the route of going overground and encircling our nutrients and creating stomachs, and the mycelium chose the route of going underground and externally digesting its nutrients and then bringing in its nutrients through these cell walls. And so mycelium conforms to string theory, and the organization of matter in the universe follows strings of matter. And as we go further out in larger and larger dimensions, we see these same type of mycelial archetypes throughout nature. Networks are resilient. They survive from catastrophia. They're able to regrow and survive, and that is the way of nature. And I have the sense that we're part of this larger fabric, and we call it same self-recognition. When mycelium grows, it achieves fabric-like structures that gives it the ability to be able to navigate through very complex ecosystems. There's so many examples, and I've been fortunate in that, you know, this is my time. I am the mycelial messenger, perhaps. There's a lot of other, thousands of other people before me and thousands of other people that will come after me. My trust and belief in the deep intelligence of nature keeps bringing rewards that shocks people, that has been verified scientifically, that opens up many new opportunities. And I have there are some things that are implicitly true in life, and I have to say that I think I've found a deep well of knowledge. And literally every day that I wake up, I'm happy to be alive because I know my life has meaning and I can save thousands of lives, if not thousands of species. Time is short. You know, we're going to lose 50% of the species on the Earth in the next 100 years of species that we know. What about the species we don't know? Over 90% of species in the kingdom of fungi are unknown. We only know about 10% of all the species that are out there. And so we have a little bit of knowledge. And the little bit of knowledge we have and what we know about it and how rapidly we're losing these candidate species means that we are losing tools in our biological tool chest. And I have a great concern that if humans don't get their act together, and this petty politics just is a bunch of cacophony that distracts people from the issues we should be really focused on. Frankly, I don't care about American Idol. Frankly, I don't care about the Republican Party. This is just a bunch of noise as a ship is sinking. We should be focusing 100% on preserving the ecosystems because these ecosystems are our children's destiny. And I fear and I sense that children in the future are pointing and calling back in time, pointing the fingers at us, asking us, what the hell were you thinking? What are you doing? And there is a growing legion of micro-warriors, I hope, that are emerging around the planet to pick up this cause. And my book, Mycelium Running, you know, is a manual for the mycological rescue of the planet. It's a powerful book. It's one book, I think, in a series of manuals that people can use to help reverse course or change course. Because smallpox doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. Smallpox doesn't care about borders. You know, these viral epidemics are going to have a great leveling effect, politically speaking. Because once they emerge out of the landscape, we're going to all have to work together very, very rapidly. And prevention is a lot better than treating after the fact. And every hour that we spent trying to prevent these viral epidemics and the loss of species from going down the toilet, frankly, there'll be time very, very well spent.
One of the things that I recommend that our listeners do is go to dhlovelife.com. That's Daryl Hannah, lovelife.com. And she interviewed you. There's a 5-minute segment on her website that's video, and she goes into your mushroom, I guess it's a farm that you would call it, right?
Mm-hmm. We have a large laboratory complex here, and we grow about 200 to 300 species of mushrooms. And I think in Daryl Hannah's video, we show about 8 or 9 of them.
Yeah, so that was simply amazing. And there's a key point in that video from the visualization standpoint that I think that our listeners would enjoy. And that is you lift up a bunch of wood chips and you show what mycelium is.
Anyone can go outside right now and find a piece of wood that's been on the ground and just lift it up and you'll see mycelium. Mycelium is a not-so-invisible landscape that is underfoot all around you at all times. And I propose to you that the mycelium is conscious. There is a consciousness there. And we need to engage these intelligent organisms for our mutual benefit. Now, whether you believe they are conscious or not, it doesn't really matter. See what they can do. You know, and the proof is in their activity. You know, we've been able to break down diesel and oil spills from 20,000 parts per million of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons to less than 200 in 8 weeks, thus being able to clean up habitats so they would rebound with all sorts of other organisms. Otherwise, they are anemic biologically, nearly sterile environments, and extremely toxic. The fungi are the leading-edge organisms in nature. Just as they came to land, the first organisms that came to land over 1.3 billion years ago, these fungi are edge runners. And being edge runners, they like interface environments. And as they go across a habitat, then they build food webs that support all sorts of other organisms that ride behind them. And so people need to understand that these fungi are extremely and powerful environmental healers. And when we engage them purposefully, then they can be fantastic allies for helping us repair the ecosystems that we have so severely damaged.
So should I go out and commune with the mycelium and sit with them? I mean, it makes me want to take psilocybin mushrooms and have a big conversation is what it inspires me to do. But
been there, done that.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess for me, as you know, for my show, not necessarily that my interests represent all of our listeners, but so what I'm inspired because I hear you saying, all right, mushrooms definitely are able to heal pollution or contaminated soil, you know, so there's that element. There's the smallpox element. There's just the cool factor that, hey, we're losing a lot of our ecosystem. Let's focus on mushrooms. Sounds like a great idea. And there's all, this is a great conversation because it wraps in consciousness and nature and politics and oil spills in the environment. And I've been asking each of my guests to give an eco challenge that they can take on through next year's Earth Day. So in the next portion of our interview, what I'd like to do is talk to you about what we can do as, you know, I'm just living my life, doing my thing, and I'd love to commune with mushrooms and help get this story out, and I'd like to be able to have an eco challenge for myself and our listeners that would really let us be messengers for you and keep the mushroom consciousness alive in us.
I mean, in order to get the most mileage from this communication, I would definitely reiterate that please get my book, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. There's a lot of information that it will, I think, convince people, even the people who are most skeptical. My eco or myco challenge would be for every listener out there to indeed go sit with nature and then explore with your hands, dig into the soil, smell the richness of the soil, and find these mycelial lenses that are all around you. Every mycelial lens outgasses fragrant signatures, and the forest ecosystem smells so good largely because of the fragrances of the mycelium that's outgassing. And understand these mycelial lenses and how vast they are and how many there are, and then to identify, if you can, target 10 edible mushrooms that you can learn how to identify. They're very easy. Morels are very easy. Shaggy manes are very easy. You choose, you know, the 10 most common edible mushrooms in your area, learn how to identify them, and then take children into the woods. And when you are picking the mushrooms, then show that the mushrooms come from this hidden, invisible network just beneath the surface of the soil, and these fungi create this very soils that give us life. The mushrooms are like the tips of an iceberg. Unfortunately, it's the tip of a sinking iceberg as we lose biodiversity. but it's important that children are familiarized as quickly as possible that we live in symbiosis, and we are symbiotic communities, and even humans, we're just not one species. We're these large mosaics of microbes, and I may be speaking with one voice. This is the voice of Paul Stamets, and all the listeners may be listening in a sense as one individual, but in fact we are composites. And so it's my microbial community speaking to yours. And these fungal networks that exist in nature, not only are they a great example of networks and resiliency, but I don't think most people know that they're walking upon these things and they breed life, the absence of which, you know, we will have biologically anemic environments. The other, I wrote Al Gore and Richard Branson, they haven't written back, but I wrote a two-page document on reversing global warming and saving biodiversity by investing in humus. When the mycelium is made of 90% approximately the mycelium, and mushrooms are complex carbohydrates, and they sequester carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And the mycelium, as it grows, these wonderful acid crystals called oxalic acid, which is two carbon dioxide molecules joined together. And so as the mycelium grows, not only internally does it have these carbon-rich compounds like proteins, and but the cell walls are these exoskeletons that are extremely high in polysaccharides, carbohydrates. And then the mycelium is also producing all of these crystals that take CO2 out of the atmosphere. By investing in the fungal life cycles, we not only take CO2 out of the atmosphere, but we build humus. So the carbon sink and the carbon bank of soils is increased. And as soils are increased, they have a better carrying capacity of more biodiversity. And we reinvest then in ecosystems that can further support life. And the opposite trend, I think it will be obvious to any listener, is a form of ecological suicide. We are engaged right now in ecological suicide. And you put a dome over Shanghai, how long will that city survive? One day, maybe 2 days. You know, there are regions of this world that if you amplify them as an example of an ecosystem, there will be no life. Certainly life and not as we know it. And that's what I think is happening is a growing plague of deforestation that is occurring around our planet. And once CO2 levels hit 10,000 parts per million, all large animals will die off. And that trend is a trend that we're going towards right now. And I wish people would spend more attention to this issue than so much of the political cacophony that dominates the airways.
Well, you've got my attention, and I'll definitely be messengering as much as I can. So I really appreciate you committing your life to this. I mean, it's really wonderful to experience. It's just clear that that's who you are in the world. You've chosen your thing, and this is what you're doing. Before we wrap up our interview, there's two questions and things that I'd like to talk to you. One's a little more about mushrooms, and then the other is about your martial arts, about your black belt. I'm also a martial artist, so I'm curious, a little curious about that. Before I ask you about that, Paul, a friend of mine told me about the recognizing mushrooms, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about what happens when we take the time in nature to explore mushrooms, what might happen to us.
Well, mushrooms can be invisible to the naked eye, and they can be right in front of you, and people just can't see them. There have been many times that I've actually sat down in the woods, you know, mushroom hunting and not being able to find mushrooms, and I'm sitting there quiet in the forest resting, and I look over, and the very mushrooms I'm looking for are right by my feet sometimes. I've had several examples of like that. And when you create this visual picture in your brain, and when you have this memory image, then you can then pattern your memory image across the landscape, and suddenly all these mushroom species will start jumping out at you, whereas before you did not notice them at all. Mushrooms also have a very keen sense of humor. The psilocybin mushrooms are most often found in the Northwest around law enforcement facilities, courthouses, universities, and churches. So if you want to go find psilocybin mushrooms in the Northwest, go to your local sheriff's department. It's a little bit of a problem, frankly. But, I mean, they have a very peculiar sense of humor, and it seems like the institutions that need them the most is where they tend to migrate to. Folks, I'm being absolutely serious. It's funny, but it's true. So, you know, mushrooms have appeared to me in the strangest of ways. There's a psilocybe species called Psilocybe sylvatica. Only two collections have been made in Washington State in the past 40 years. I was a starving student living at the end of a dead-end road, you know, A-frame with no power and no water. And one night around 11 o'clock, I felt emboldened to stand up, and I walked through the woods at night on the old abandoned logging road, and there was no moon, and I suddenly stopped, frozen, and I leaned down in total darkness, and I put my hand on top of the species that's only been collected twice, you know, over decades. Shivers went up and down my spine. It was too dark. I didn't have a flashlight. I pulled out my wallet, and I threw some paper on the ground, thinking that I'll come back, because what I felt like it was one of these mushrooms that I was seeking. The next morning, I came back, and there was a second collection of this species called Psilocybe sylvatica, which means woodland mushroom, ever collected. How does that happen? I mean, how does that happen? The improbability of that is beyond mathematics, and yet it happened. So mushrooms have called to me, and I think they can call to many people. And if we seek them, they will find us more so than we finding them.
Well, I'm glad that I found you. We're going to wrap up our show today speaking a little bit about what it means to you to be living green and give our listeners a sense of your spiritual practice, what your day looks like, what your connection to God, Source, Divine is. And if you would be willing, give us just a little intimate view into you, what we wouldn't get on the conference circuit or reading literature about you, but what is moving you throughout your day?
Well, my mother's had a great influence on me. I grew up in a highly charismatic Christian environment, and my mother is a charismatic Christian leader. She has a kind of a group of people that have built a vast facility around her in eastern Washington. My mother has raised a group of children who are very much scientists and who are non-charismatic in their belief system, but we inherently know that my mother believes in the power of goodness. And I had a great epiphany one day, and I'm always trying to build bridges between people on the far left and the far right. And this whole thing about intelligent design and the conflict with evolution, and I woke up one morning with this great epiphany, and I called my mother, who has a group of people who pray for me every day. Frankly, I like that. I'll accept all the good wishes that I can get. And I told my mother that I had this great epiphany. I wanted to share it with her because I think it's a bridge between people who think they're on polar opposites, but they actually aren't. And I made this actually into a bumper sticker. And it is, evolution is God's intelligent design. And I think that says it all, is that the mystery of nature is, and that of God is far greater than that which our minds, with all their limitations, can even begin to comprehend. And if we acknowledge that we are ignorant in the face of nature and God's complexity, then any interpretation that we have of God is inherently flawed, which doesn't mean that you can't be spiritual. It just means that as we struggle to understand the vastness of the universe, whether you believe in the one deity or whether you believe in nature, I think it's all one and the same. And ultimately, I think that there's a chasm between people who believe in nature versus people who believe in God will narrow. And indeed, nature and God is one.
All the microorganism, all the microorganism. Dive in the gene pool, down you swim, down to where the light grows dim. Flail, little fishies, flail if you can, but avoid the microorganism, man. All the microorganism, all the microorganism. Gonna find in me when they do the autopsy, the microorganism won't get me.
And that was a part of Microorganism, and I'm afraid I couldn't tell you whether that was the Feline Starship cover version or if that was the original from Boiled in Lead. It seemed like a good introduction to the following talk by fermentation expert Sandor Katz. This is called The Art of Fermentation from 2012, and I definitely appreciate whoever it was who recorded it and sent it my way. It really isn't a good recording, but I've given it my best shot to tidy it up and remove the noise. It's still very far from perfect. However, if you can stick with it, it's a fascinating talk. My wife is an avid fermenter of foods, and this talk has certainly inspired me to spend more time on that myself.
Mostly what I do is I teach people how to make sauerkraut. And I have to say that I feel a little bit naked standing in front of a group of people without a knife and a cutting board and a head of cabbage. And, you know, really, like, what I love doing more than anything else is just, you know, sharing, you know, like, skills. And that's what my books are really all about. But I want to use this time here today, and I don't want to talk for too long because it's really, you know, it's more fun for you and more fun for me if, you know, we have more of an interactive exchange. But there's, you know, sort of like three big sort of, you know, themes that, you know, I've been thinking about in relation to fermentation. And, you know, one I would say is evolution. One is culture. And one is community. So I'm going to sort of, you know, try to briefly address fermentation as it relates to, you know, sort of each of these three, you know, huge, broad themes. Let me start with evolution. There's a huge amount of speculative literature that theorizes about the idea, you know, how did humans invent fermentation? You know, how did people, you know, figure out how to make alcohol? And, you know, humans did not invent fermentation. It would be far more accurate to turn it around and say that fermentation invented humans. You know, I don't know, maybe we have some creationists in the room, but if you subscribe to the theory of evolution, you know, all life is descended from bacteria. You know, it seems like the emerging idea is that, you know, it was a symbiosis between fermenting bacteria and other early microorganisms, you know, gave rise to the first eukaryotic cells, the, you know, cells, you know, of which, you know, animals, plants, and fungi are composed. And so, you know, the corollary to the idea that all life is evolved from bacteria is that no life has ever lived without bacteria. So, you know, in our own human bodies, you know, bacteria are absolutely essential. Despite the sort of cultural indoctrination that all of us have received, that bacteria are bad, bacteria are dangerous, we want to kill all the bacteria, you know, we want to buy soaps that promise to kill 99.9% of bacteria, it is not really desirable for us to kill all the bacteria. We couldn't survive without bacteria. You know, bacteria play all sorts of essential, you know, roles in our physiology and our functioning. Bacteria synthesize nutrients that are essential to us. Bacteria enable us to digest nutrients that we wouldn't otherwise be able to digest. Bacteria make nutrients bioavailable to us. Bacteria protect us from the, you know, really fairly limited number of bacteria that have the potential to make us sick. And, you know, there's just all of this sort of emerging information about all of the ways in which our gut bacteria mediate other, you know, immune responses and other kinds of physiological processes. I mean, recently there was an exciting new report that found that when a person fights a lung infection, it's actually gut bacteria that are, you know, mediating that immune response. So, you know, clearly, you know, bacteria are, you know, very important to human beings and really to all animals. Now, thinking about plants, you know, plants are no less dependent upon bacteria than we are. So no plant lives in a sterile environment. There is no sterile environment other than ones created through extraordinary means in university campuses and government facilities. But, you know, everywhere else, you know, there's just all sorts of microorganisms. There's also no such thing as singular microorganisms. You never find, you know, a single species of bacteria, a single species of mold. Like, they just don't exist in the natural world. You know, thinking about plants and bacteria, and then humans harvesting plants to eat them, we're never just eating the plants. We're eating the plants and the bacteria. And then, especially once we start thinking about how to store food, You know, as human beings, you know, sort of slowly moved from, you know, migratory hunter-gatherer societies where each day people were engaged in procuring the food resources to get them through that day. You know, once people started thinking about storing food, you know, it just becomes all about how do you work with the bacteria? How do you dry food effectively so that it prevents bacteria from consuming the dead plant material that you're going to eat? People inevitably observed, you know, under different types of storage conditions, different things happened to their food. So, for instance, you know, just picturing a contemporary vegetable, a head of cabbage, you know, if you take a piece of cabbage and leave it on your kitchen counter, you know, you could leave it there for 2 days, you could leave it there for 2 weeks, you could leave it there for 2 months, you could leave it there for 2 years, and it is never going to turn itself into sauerkraut. There are a multitude of different types of organisms on that head of cabbage. If you leave it just sitting on the counter, exposed to air, what's going to happen, and I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who's ever had an experience like this, is you'll get dark-colored molds growing on the cabbage, and if it's hot enough, if it's humid enough, if you had the poor judgment to leave it on the counter wrapped in plastic, that mold could literally reduce a head of cabbage into a puddle of slime. And the puddle of slime, you know, bears no resemblance whatsoever to delicious, crunchy, tangy sauerkraut. And so if a vegetable is exposed to air, molds are what are going to become dominant on that every single time. If, on the other hand, you manage to submerge the cabbage under liquid, then the molds can't grow because they don't have access to oxygen. And so what's going to grow instead are lactic acid bacteria. And the lactic acid bacteria are going to give it a nice tangy flavor. And then they're going to make it impossible for any of the bacteria that we would regard as pathogenic bacteria to remain alive, even if they were present on the cabbage in the first place. And by the way, the bacteria that creates a toxin, which is considered the substance most toxic to humans of any other substance, Clostridium botulinum, that produces a toxin that we know as botulism, it's a common soil bacteria. It's everywhere, and it probably is present on every head of cabbage. But the only environmental condition in which Clostridium botulinum, you know, ever has the possibility of proliferating and creating that toxin is if you heat it up to the point where you kill all the other bacteria. One of the things that distinguishes Clostridium botulinum is that it has the sporulating form that is extremely heat resistant, and it can even resist boiling temperatures. And so that's why in canning it's important to pressure cook things, because you elevate the temperature even higher than boiling, and you have to hold it there for a certain amount of time in order to kill all the Clostridium botulinum. You don't have to worry about this in the fermentation context at all, because the lactic acid bacteria are so much more prevalent, and every single time you submerge cabbages underwater, what will dominate, and as they acidify the environment, they'll kill off the Clostridium botulinum that might be present. The only time it ever has the opportunity to develop is in improperly heated canned food. So if you can something, heat it to the point where everything else dies, the lactic acid bacteria dies, the mold spores die, the only thing that survives is Clostridium botulinum, and you've left it in this perfect vacuum, the perfect anaerobic environment that it needs in order to proliferate, then the Clostridium botulinum grows. And the only reason we all know the word botulism is because in the context of canning, which was, you know, invented like almost exactly 200 years ago, a Frenchman named Nicolas Appert invented the process for canning sterilization. During the 19th and early 20th century, there were all of these, you know, like scandalous stories where entire families died eating a jar of, you know, canned string beans or whatever that hadn't been subjected to quite enough heat. Anyway, I mean, this is just to illustrate that, you know, on every, you know, on all plant matter, there is a multitude of microorganisms, not just a single one. And there is sort of, there's an inevitability of our having to deal with these organisms. You know, I mean, fermentation or microbial transformations, because, you know, fermentation specifically describes anaerobic organisms. And there are anaerobic as well as aerobic organisms on everything. But microbial transformations of our food are an inevitability. And so, you know, either our food decomposes into forms that are not at all palatable to us, or else we figure out how to, you know, harness the power of the microorganisms to turn the food into something that is, you know, more delicious, more stable, more digestible, or, you know, in some ways, better than it was. Coexisting with microorganisms is a biological imperative. The fermentation arts are the human cultural manifestations of this biological imperative. As we evolved with bacteria. As human cultural practices evolved, they evolved in the context of the reality that bacteria and fungi were part of all of our food. And we, you know, even though it's only in the last, 150 years that we have been, sort of specifically conceptualizing it as, microorganisms, they still were no less of a reality that people had to deal with. And this is why cultures all around the world, I do not know about every single cultural tradition, culinary tradition that exists around the world, but I've looked really hard for a counterexample of any kind of, culinary tradition that does not incorporate any kind of fermentation, and I can't find any, and I have come to firmly believe that they just could not exist because of this, sort of inevitability of the presence of fermenting organisms or all sorts of organisms on our food. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about culture. Culture is a big word. Culture describes, science and language and literature and music and religious practices and beliefs and the totality of all the people seek to pass down from generation to generation. When we look at the word culture, it comes from Latin for cultivation. And, the idea is that the, origins of culture or whatever are, is related to the cultivation of the soil and the development of, ideas about, how to do that. We're developing techniques that we, that we are passing down and all that comes with that. I think it's then we also use the same word to describe little communities of bacteria. So, when we make yogurt and transfer a scoop of mature yogurt containing not only yogurt, but these bacteria that have turned the milk into yogurt, and we introduce that into new milk, we call that a culture, and we call the act of introducing it into the milk is culturing. So, I think it's fascinating that we use the same word to describe these little, communities of bacteria that we have harnessed to transform our food, that we use to describe this, sort of totality of everything that we seek to pass down from generation to generation. And as it turns out, in so many human cultures, these cultured foods are really central to culinary traditions and even to cultural identity. So, many cultures around the world have very distinctive foods that people within the culture are acculturated to, be able to enjoy. And yet people from outside of the culture who might come and visit or might be exposed to the culture are often very put off by some of these foods. So one culture's, sort of highest expression of their, culinary arts is often, the worst nightmare of somebody who's outside of the culture. I was recently reading about a Hawaiian and South Pacific ferment called poi, which is fermented taro. And I was reading an anthropologist's account from the 1930s. And, the anthropologist who was writing this paper found the poi so horribly distasteful that he speculated that there must be like a gene, a poi gene, that,